to order. Senator Hawkins, Senator Olson, Senator Stedman, and myself, Senator Green, are here. Senator Wilkins stepped out just for just a moment. We have several things on the agenda this morning. Senate Bill 73 will take up first, then 157. House Bill 54, and then House Bill 286. And we're waiting on amendments or CSs on a couple of the other bills, and somehow one, I think House Bill 218, dropped off the schedule, and we're going to bring that up as well at some point today. Senate Bill 73 has to do with the virology lab and certificates of participation. And this is a governor's bill. Who is here to do the explaining? Oh, Dr. Monsager. Now, yesterday at the table, there was also a question about what exactly are certificates of participation. So if we could have that explanation as well, or find someone to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson Green and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Monsager. For the record, I'm the Director of Division of Public Health. John Clark, the Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health, and Mr. Mitchell from the Department of Revenue is here to answer the questions about certificates of participation.
Okay, very good.
So I'm just going to briefly answer a couple of the questions that came up last night about the virology laboratory for the members of the committee that haven't heard this in HESS committee when it was heard earlier in this session, if that's okay. You have a handout in front of you. I'm not going to spend the time to go through the whole handout. It looks like this. It's in your packet of information. And I'm just going to take 2 or 3 minutes just to say what is a virology laboratory. The first question is, what does the word virology mean? It's the study of viruses. And it's the laboratory, the location up in Fairbanks is the lab that does the identification of common things like influenza, measles, pertussis, other kinds of things like that. The uncommon things it does is rabies. And that's kind of its main business up here in our state, hepatitis. The things that are coming in the future potentially that are important, and the reason why it's important for us as a state to have an up-to-date laboratory, have to do with subjects such as avian flu. The bird flu that we've heard about over the last several years is in Southeast Asia right now with a 70-plus mortality rate right now. It's bird flu. It's transmitted birds to humans, and the only people that are getting it really are people that live in close proximity to birds. However, this winter, the first cases of human-to-human transmission appear to have occurred in Southeast Asia. And the big concern of public health folks all over the world is if this mutates, if it changes to become transmissible human-to-human, this is a very bad disease. And we need to have an identification ability quickly. It is linked to our isolation and quarantine abilities as a state to be able to isolate, and planes come in from Southeast Asia. People are sick. Is this common flu or is this a bad type of flu? That's an example of why it's important. The slides in front of you have some pictures of the old facilities in Fairbanks. The people, our staff who work there, they're dealing with really bad viruses, and these days too of man-made release of things. The laboratory facilities need to be at a level we call Basic Safety Laboratory 3, BSL 3. There's in the country, there's about 23 to 25 BSL 3 labs. There are two BSL 4 labs, and there's one what's called a BSL 4 plus lab in the country. So this is one of the few laboratories right now with this old physical plant. They operate with the practices of a BSL 3, but the facility doesn't meet standards. We need to get there as a state. It's important for us, and that's what this bill will do, is position us for the next decades to come. The preference is to have it in Fairbanks so we can work in partnership with the university. It'll further their research mission in Fairbanks, and it'll also give us as a state redundancy if we have earthquakes and lose the bacteriology and chemical toxics laboratory we have at the lab in Anchorage. We then have a redundancy in Fairbanks, or vice versa. With that, I'm available to answer questions. Ms. Clark is, and Mr. Mitchell is.
Did you have anything to add, Janet?
No, Madam Chairman. I think what I'll do is have Devin Mitchell come up, and he can talk about the certificates of participation.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for being here.
And for the record, Janet Clark.
Okay, thank you. Devin, come forward. Are there any questions for Dr. Monsager? Many of the members. I know most of us have already heard of this in committee, or in the newspaper or in some of the other handouts. Devin, welcome. Could you explain to us how this is going to be financed?
Sure. Devin Mitchell, debt manager in Department of Revenue. And the proposed structure would be, as you indicated, certificates of participation, which would be facilitated by a lease that would be entered into between the Department of Administration and the a trustee bank that would be given a title position. That title position facilitates the flow of money from the state of Alaska to the bond purchasers, and so that's how they are able to participate in the lease, and thus why they're called certificates of participation. In this case, we were looking at the $24.2 million, including the cost of issuance associated with the certificates. Annual debt service at a 4.9 interest or true interest cost would be just under $2.4 million annually for 15 years. This interest rate is still above current interest rates. We'd be closer to 4% in the low 4.2% range if we were to issue these certificates today. The anticipated timing of the sale is, if this legislation were passed, would be this fall, as early as September, to facilitate the planning process to meet construction cycles in 2006. If there were questions, I guess one point, as long as I'm here and knowing otherwise the committee's concern about this type of lease commitment generally, there has been a lot of discussion with the rating analysts about proposals, various proposals of the state of Alaska as they've been developing. And generally, the state's credit rating at the AA level, again, there's been a lot of discussion about what might need to happen in order to maintain that credit rating. And one of the topics has been a limitation on the issuance of additional obligations of the state's general fund prior to a long-term fiscal plan being implemented by the state of Alaska. And while currently we have positive budget position, we don't have something that plans for projected fiscal situations in 4 or 5 years or even shorter term than that, depending on what commodity prices wind up being. At this level, at the $24.2 million level, there was a positive feedback that we would be within, I'm not sure if it's under the radar or within the buffer zone, whichever you want to call it, where we would be issuing an obligation that wouldn't raise the eyebrows of the rating analysts that track the state to the point that they would be considering taking any credit action against the state. So that's a long-winded way of saying that we believe that this would not impact the state's credit rating.
Senator Shedman, you had asked a question yesterday. Is that
satisfactory? Oh, that's fine, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions about the virology lab? I'm sorry you got to miss this, Senator Wilkin.
So yes, go ahead. Did the change of location, is that in the CS, where it became optional, doesn't have to be on the campus?
Okay. Yes, yes.
Is that in there? Okay.
Okay. You're exactly right. Okay. Sorry, I forgot to mention that.
And that's
do we need to adopt the CS? Oh, Senator Wilkin, would you move the CS, please?
Madam Chair, move to adopt Committee Substitute Percent of Bill 73 of Version F by Bannister on 5-5 as our working document.
Objection. Okay, the Bannister Version F is our working draft for today. And I know many of us, like I said, have heard this many times already in committee. And this is one of those bills that works in partnership with the budget item we had included in our capital budget yesterday. Are there any further questions that any of the members of the committee have? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 73 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Being no objection, Senate Bill 73 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you.
You bet. Yes. 57. This is, again, is a bill by the request of the governor and an act relating to the maximum annual regulatory cost charge collected from certain regulated public utilities. Senator Wilken, can I get you to move the CS?
Madam Chair, move to that the committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 157, version F by Craver on 5-6 as our working document.
Objection? 157 is our working draft. We also have Attorney General on the record as well. And who is presenting on behalf of the governor? Good morning, Kate. If you'd introduce yourself and give your association, we'll begin your testimony, please.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the Senate Finance Committee, my name is Kate Guyard, and I am the chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Kate, could I get you to move the microphone a little bit closer to you and get that right at your chin, please?
Okay. I don't usually talk so softly, but I wanted to do a few things this morning in the few minutes that I have before you to testify. And the first is to talk about the Regulatory Commission of Alaska as a whole and why you have before you this bill today. I was confirmed by this body in June of 2003 to work as a commissioner for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. When I accepted the role, I learned and I'd heard through the Sunset hearings that there were a lot of challenges that the public, the utilities, and the legislature had with the overall functionality of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. On July 1st of this last year, 2004, I ran for and was elected chairman. And the purpose of running for chair and being elected to chair was to have the opportunity to address those issues. Over the last 6 or 7 months, the chair has gone and talked to public utilities, pipeline companies, legislators about what were the issues that were driving some of the major concerns that the legislature and the utilities had about the RCA. The overall goal is to identify and form working groups to work together to address the RCA's problems over the next 2 years before Sunset comes back to you. We will be successful. I will view my time with the RCA as being successful. If we can bring you a Sunset in 2007, which does not have the plethora of issues that you have always faced when addressing and dealing with the RCA or its former predecessor, the APUC. So in doing that, we formulated some strategies and plans, some of which you see before you now in the form of an RCC increase. Some of them deal with regulations and inviting and welcoming in public comment on our activities. And we will continue this process through the next 2 years before we come back to you again and discuss Sunset. What you have before you today increases the RCC rate by 0.2% from 7 to 9 for a 3-year period. The purpose of that is to provide funding so that the RCA can acquire the systems that it needs to run its operations much more efficiently. Today, the RCA is primarily manual in systems. It's made very little investment in coming up to speed with data processing systems that would help us get our work done. For example, I don't know, as the chairman, what the day-to-day activities of our staff are. I don't know because we lack the systems and the reporting, who's working on what dockets, how many hours we're spending, and where dockets are. That translates into you hearing that we're not getting our orders out promptly, that utilities don't know where things are in the process, and that it takes an extremely long time to get an order or an answer from the RCA. You've heard comments from Marathon. You've heard comments from many, many utilities about the challenges of getting information from the RCA. We can deal with those challenges. It is not rocket science, and we are capable of putting in systems to address those concerns. We worked with the utilities. We had public hearings on this RCC funding mechanism. Utilities came to us and said, gee, we're kind of uncomfortable with what you're doing. We would like you to form an advisory group comprised of utilities. We did do that in January. The advisory group went over our strategy. It was comprised of MLMP, GCI, I'm going to hurt somebody's feelings if I don't remember, and Chugach. And they came together with us and helped us, in addition to the state personnel, formulate a plan. The result of that is that the utilities felt much more comfortable that we were going to acquire systems, that we're going to deliver the services that they need. And what they need is a way of transmitting data to us that's electronic. Chugach had 65,000 documents in the last rate case. All of them were handled manually. So we are going to address those problems with this funding and this acquisition. The money moves into the operating fund rather than capital fund. And I would like to explain to you why that is. The way the statute is written for our RCCs, we collect those fees from the utilities and the pipeline companies, but the utilities collect them from their ratepayers, as do the pipeline companies. When we collect fees, if we do not spend that money, it falls to the bottom line and reduces the amount of RCCs that those ratepayers have to pay in the next year. So if we put this money into capital and did not put it into operating, it would just sit there and never have that impact on the ratepayer. And because we're acquiring systems and we don't know actually how much they're going to cost, we have a sense, it may be that we do not spend all this money, and I wanted the ability for it to fall down and reduce the RCC rate in the next year. So that's why you see the money staying and operating. And it's all in contract, and I placed it in contract, the contractual line, because I wanted to let you know we weren't going to be hiring additional people, we're not going to be adding positions, we're not going to use this money for anything other than what we've said that we're going to use the money for. We will also continue with the advisory group, so the utilities and pipeline entities will be on board with us throughout the whole process. There is an amendment, which I can also discuss, that was added, and I guess I'd like to deal with them in two sections with your permission, and if you have any questions for me on the RCC, I'd be happy to address them at this time.
Do you have any questions? Any members have any questions for Kate Gaillard? It's certainly a pleasure having you here under these circumstances. It seems like at other times when we've had things going on, it was not quite as calm in the building as it is now. Senator Wilkin, you had an ad?
No, you're right. This ain't the good old days.
Oh, no, this is great. Go ahead, Kate.
Madam Chair, I would like to take on the record, because I know several of the utilities and pipeline companies are listening today.
Okay.
And it is a very rare experience, I think, for the legislature to see legislation, first of all, supported by the governor and brought forward by the RCA, which has not been become a substantial area of controversy before the legislature. I asked, and the utilities responded to and held off significantly from making this legislation be a center point. And I think that we owe any success that results from this venture to those pipeline companies and utilities that did participate and that did respectfully say, we support this and we are going to not move forward and take any advantage of this situation. There was an amendment that came through, which I fully support because I think it's good public policy, but it doesn't have the Christmas tree effect that I think, I didn't know what that word meant, I certainly do now, that people were telling me could happen. So I do want to take those few moments and say a very sincere thank you to the legislature and to those utility and pipeline companies.
Are there any other questions of Ms. Gaillard? I know when I first heard this about this, I thought, oh, it's just another method by which our ratepayers are going to pay more to our utilities so our utilities can pay more for something. And then the explanation of I think in some ways you nearly outdo us in some respects, some months of the year in paper.
in the volumes of paper that they handle. And it's currently all primarily manual at this time, and they have no ongoing record or ability to change and edit as they go along. And so this puts them in the next century, or in the current century, instead of being... So I'm fully supportive of this, and hope to see them do well and raise lots of money and get their operations in place. Are there any questions? Oh, Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, it seems like the CS picked up a title change, so I was looking to see. And it appears to be on page 2, section 3. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, having to do with, it seems like we're indemnifying public utility for damages may or may not have been caused by operating a transmission line. So I wonder if we could put that issue on the table here.
Yes,
and I have some questions that might be part of the record.
Senator, through the chair, Senator Wilkin, would you prefer to ask your questions and I can respond, or would you?
If we could. Mr. Garrett, are you familiar with the recent Section 3 regarding a prohibition on the ability of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to order electric utilities to operate their systems differently, that are different than design or safety standards, and relieving the utility of liability in order to operate in such a manner?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, are you asking me, is there a prohibition on that?
I'm asking you, are you familiar with Section 3?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. Is it your understanding that the amendment is directed at the manner in which RCA is requiring that the 20-mile segment of the transmission line that is owned and operated by Matanuska Electric Association? Is that
yes,
Section
sir.
3?
Through the chair.
Is the line at issue used as part of the Alaska Intertie, which is the major transmission line between Anchorage utilities and the northern interior of the state?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Okay. How long has that line been operating?
Through the chair, it's approximately 20 years.
Did the RCA hold hearings on the manner involving the manner in which MEA was intending to operate their line?
Through the chair, yes.
Who was involved in those hearings?
I have, through the chair, I have before me an order that the RCA issued. U03-100 was the docket. It was order number 4. And the parties to that proceeding were Chugach, GVEA, MLMP, and City of Seward, as well as MEA.
And did you have experts at that hearing?
The chair, yes. There were experts, as is normal, on both sides of the hearing.
Okay. Did the designer of that line testify?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, this particular order has been appealed to the Superior Court, and therefore to get into the details of the hearing is particularly difficult to me. I'm happy to speak to you, however, about this section and give you a bit of a historical background on it that I think you may be seeking. In my own words, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Okay. If you would, please.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, as part of the learning process of going through, you haven't seen me here much, so I had to learn this process. This bill was moving forward through House, and there was also a Senate version. It did not have this particular version that you have before you. It was simply dealt with the RCCs. This week, we learned that there had been some concerns on behalf of MEA about this order that we issued. And MEA had proposed initially that they would like this order to be overturned. That is a public policy issue, which the RCA could not support. One of the primary concerns that MEA had was that because we ordered interconnection, the current intertie runs using 26 or 20 miles, roughly, of MEA's lines called the TLS. And for many, many years, 20 years since the intertie was created, it used MEA's TLS line to transmit those 20 miles because the funding was low and they thought that was more efficient that it would happen. And so for 20 years, they've been under contract. MEA made a claim that it was no longer going to offer that service to the intertie because they weren't able to negotiate terms and conditions the MEA was comfortable with. We had a hearing and we issued an order stating and requiring MEA to interconnect. In that order, we can copy for you and let you have. MEA, in that, MEA had some concerns about safety and about the safety of the line, because we ordered MEA to connect the line and run the, transmit the kilowatts at 138. And the line was originally designed for 115, and that is all in the public record, and so I am comfortable talking to you about that portion of it. When I spoke with MEA about their concerns and their desire to have this order overturned within the legislative process, I spoke with them and explained to them that I felt that was bad public policy, because there is a mechanism the legislature put in place for MEA or any public utility or pipeline to deal with orders that they do not like that are issued from the RCA, and that is to go from the RCA to the Superior Court and then up to Supreme Court. And the courts will tell us if we have not done our job well. So when we were able to talk to MEA, we spoke with them, and they decided to withdraw their desire. They understood the public policy concerns and did not want to violate them. And really, it boiled down to what they were concerned about was their liability. They are and have been offering this service to the state of Alaska, but unlike any other utility along the rail belt, if someone does get injured with that line being run at 138 kV, the utility stands in place of the intertie. The state of Alaska stands in place for the rest of the intertie through the AEA. So I felt that I was confident that it was good public policy, probably policy that could have been enacted 20 years ago when this structure was originally designed, that if this line does cause liability while it is being used as the intertie, and there is some discussion underfoot or construction plans underway that it'll only be used for the next 3 to 5 years on this mechanism, that it is good public policy that this little that this public utility not be held more accountable or more liable than other utilities along the rail belt. Now, this was the beginning of a conversation which then we needed to also communicate this to GVEA, which is a utility on one end, CEA, which is Chugach Electric on another end, MLMP, and the other users of the intertie, to make sure that we were promoting a public policy and the governor's office was promoting a public policy, you know, that was broad enough and that the other utilities using this line could be comfortable with. So now I've learned that you can really achieve a lot in about 48 hours, because we went through that discussion process with those other utilities. And the result was, although the utilities felt, and I also feel, it would have been better had MEA come to us earlier and talked to us about that. MEA, I suppose, is appropriate in saying this was going to Superior Court, Kate. We didn't feel that we could come talk to you about this until this moment. That relationship is now evolving and changing, so hopefully this won't happen again. But we were able, with those CEOs of those entities, to come to an agreement and say, yes, this is good public policy. The governor's office also said, we believe this is good public policy, and we can accept this revision to the governor's bill. So I think that that's a fair recount of what's happened in the last 48 hours, which is why you have this bill before you. And I appreciate Senator Green allowing me to sit in her office and, you know, discuss it with MEA at great length and to help us come to this place today. So I do thank you for that.
Did you go through the Department of Law and your own attorneys to be sure that this was workable and did not had wide enough protection for all providers that it was fair?
Through the chair, yes, that is a correction on my testimony. We did take it through the Attorney General, AEA, and the other AEA's Attorney General, who also I believe is on the phone to testify to this today. And we took it through the Governor's Department of Law, and also I believe it's been through legislative legal review as well. So it has had what I believe is an appropriate legal review, but I do think the Attorney General is probably more appropriate.
appropriately testifying to that.
Brian Borquist is on the line, but I think Senator Wilken has another question.
So when I see this, and I see two things, I see an end run around the RCA's decision, and then I see, for whatever purpose, which I don't have the knowledge or the depth to understand, that we indemnify a certain utility for their future actions in regard to operating this asset. That shouldn't concern, doesn't concern you nor the governor with this bill, that Section 3 is appropriate for this bill, and you're supportive of it?
Through the chair, Senator Wilken, I do believe that I have strongly and sternly spoken to MEA about the end run issue. I don't believe that end runs are uncommon. I believe that it is probably a normal part of a process that I wasn't particularly familiar with. I look at the end result. Is the end result good public policy that the governor's office stood behind? And through this very long but short 48 hours, we arrived at that conclusion. And I would not, in good faith, sit before you and recommend that you take action that I didn't feel was good public policy. And I would have let this bill die, despite my desire to improve the RCA, had I not felt that way.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I have a different perspective on this, and it may indeed be an end run in a way that I don't perceive. But my understanding is that this 115 kVA line was asked, the new application of it went to transmit 138.
Senator Dyson, can I interrupt you just 1 minute? Kate, if we get to a point in this discussion that we cannot discuss, would you just raise your hand in lieu of the pending court decision? I don't want to put her on the spot, nor do I want us to put on the spot as well. Go ahead, Senator Dyson, go ahead.
Yeah, so they were asking a line designed for 100, transmit 115 volt kVA, transmit 138. And at the time, it was decided that by the RCA antecedents that probably could handle it. I think that the owner of the line or the operator of the line said, hey, that's marginal. It is not the recommendation of the National Electric Safety Code. And I understand that that section of line has had considerable outages, disproportionate. I have not documented that in the time. So if we in government force any entity to operate on the edges of what good national standards are and what's good safety, I don't think it's unreasonable for that group to say, hey, over our protest, you're asking us to do something that's outside of what normal recommended practice, and we want to be held harmless if we do what we're ordered to do that's outside of the national recognized standards. So it's in that view that I don't see this as an end run, but only a fairly reasonable protection for this utility to be doing something that they were reluctant to do in the future. I worked as a construction lineman when I was in college and managed or had the responsibility on the BP side of the field for electric power maintenance and generators and stuff. And I can tell you that arcing between lines and across the insulators is an issue depending on the atmospheric conditions. Now, I suspect where this section is, I haven't looked at it, it's relatively dry. But boy, when you get moisture in and around the dew point, freezing point, you know, it's really marginal. And I have not looked at their outage records to see if indeed that those are weather related. I'd be very surprised if they're not. Plus, you know, it's an old line and deteriorating efficiency of the insulation, and then you get windy conditions and the insulator's swinging at it. You know, just practically speaking, these are the kind of conditions that are problematic. I've just told you more than I know.
So. Certainly more than I know. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Chairman.
Yes.
One of the things that I feel uncomfortable about is if you have a line that's designed for one set of parameters and you're asked, being asked to step it up, as was voiced by Senator Dyson, I guess it reminds me of if I'm flying and the airplane has got a specific design weight and I'm told I'm not supposed to go over that weight, it ain't actually carry it because it's, you know, has those margins in there, but if I'm ordered to do that, I'm asking for trouble. It's going to fail one of these days, and it sounds like it has if there's outages there. But I guess that's just the comment that I have on it. My family or my dad used to operate the generator there in Golovin, and so, you know, we did a fair amount of line pulling and whatever else. But I guess one of the questions that I have is that there are ways of increasing the amount of power and staying at the design limit of 115 volt. I don't know who the end users are. I'm assuming it goes all the way to Fairbanks and Delta Junction in that area. Why not put a transformer in there that, since they're benefiting from it, put a transformer in there and keep it down at 115 so that it is within the design limits?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, those issues were brought forward at the hearing and certainly was an item discussed by MEA. We do very similarly what you do on a daily basis, is we have an opportunity to hear a complete record and you weigh and you balance and then you decide. And while we, like you, may make decisions that are really good or really bad, we have a process where it goes to Superior Court and the Superior Court looks at our decision-making process and says, yes, you were right, no, you were wrong, change this. So I think that issue is certainly keenly felt by MEA. The other parties believe that there were mitigating circumstances, and we weighed that. And I brought for you the hearing volume, which if someone would grab it, it's on the right there. Someone would be kind enough to. This is the transcripts from the hearing.
Oh, don't worry, I'll read it.
No, I'm not. No. Sometimes it's, I don't do it to be disrespectful. I just let you know that it is a balancing, and if someone, you know, you hear so much in your day-to-day life, and we do that too. So when we listened, we made that decision, and the courts will tell us, are we right, are we wrong?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other questions? And I just want to confirm that you did talk with the other entities along the line and the, I guess it'd be co-users or?
Madam Chair, yes, I did in fact speak with the entities and also I know that the Governor's Office has been very actively communicating with those entities as well. And my understanding was that they viewed this also as good public policy, but were disenchanted with the process. But what I'd like to focus on is that we're here today, and I think we're offering you something that's good for the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Ms. Gaillard? Is there anyone else in the room? I don't have anyone. Oh, Brian Yorquist is online. Did you have anything to add to the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Brian Bjorkson, an Assistant Attorney General. I have just had a chance to take a look at the CS, and there's one concept that was missing from the work that we had done earlier, and that was what we tried to do in our proposed amendment was limit the immunity from liability to the extent that the damage was caused by the operation of the line either inconsistent with its original design standards or in a manner that was a violation or inconsistent with the National Safety Code. The difference between that approach and the approach that's in this bill right now, which does not have that to the extent that the damage is caused by that, is that this would give complete immunity to the utility for any damage that might be caused by the operation of the utility or the transmission line, regardless of whether it had anything to do with the difference or the inconsistency with the design standard or the National Electric Safety Code. And so that is, I believe, is one concern that we would still have with respect to this work draft.
Any further questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Maybe I wasn't tracking fast enough. Say again exactly how you would recommend that what we have before us be modified in order to make this as good as it can be.
Through the chair, Senator. I've been quickly trying to do that, and with the new language it's a little bit difficult. But the basic concept is that the public utility would not be liable for any damages caused to the extent that the damage is caused by the operation of the transmission line at a voltage that is inconsistent with either the original design standards or the National Safety Code, and also that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska would be ordering that. With the language, I'm having a little bit of difficulty to give you specific language for that as I sit here, but I'm sure that we could work something out with all the parties.
Yeah, so, all right, so don't have your training, but it looks to me like this language here exactly accomplishes what you're talking about. But thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Kate, do you want to get online privately with the Attorney General and the administration? And
Through the chair, we would appreciate an opportunity to take a look at that and come back before you.
Thank you. We'll look forward to that later today.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 157.
We'll wait till another.
Okay. Senate Bill 54, bail review. I'm sorry.
I liked what you said first.
You were just demoted. Welcome.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Two of our favorite representatives, Samuels and Stoltz. Welcome.
Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill on behalf of Representative Stoltz and myself. This bill has several parts to it, and the first part of HB 54 deals with bail hearings. And at the present time, defendants can have a bail hearing every 24 hours, and that causes some problems for both district attorneys and for the victims of the crime. Victims of crime have a constitutional right to be at every proceeding that a defendant is at. And if a bail hearing is held 24 hours, many times a victim will be notified, leave their job, go down to the courthouse, nothing happens, go back, the next day they leave their job, they go down to the courthouse, the bail is not changed. So what HB 54 does is it would require that if there must be something that changes. If you want to have a bail hearing within 48 hours, the accused must submit in writing that new information exists for the court's consideration that was not considered at the prior bail hearing. The district attorney would be given 48 hours notice in which to notify the victim, and there would be 48 hours between bail hearings. Second part of the bill makes it clear that the victim may be introduced to the jury during the opening statement or during the jury selection process. And some judges allow this and some do not. But in our view, for Representative Stoltz and myself, if the defendant is introduced as they are, we feel that the victim of the crime also should be introduced to put a face on what happened, whether it be a crime against a person or a simple property crime. Third part of the bill, it gives the victim a right to petition a review of a sentence that falls below the set range. And if you'll remember, Madam Chair, the Blakely bill, which the legislature passed earlier this session and was signed into law, replaced the set number at a presumptive sentencing at a range. And a sentence that goes above the range would go to a jury trial. And what this bill would do is it would say if the aggregate amount of years between all the aggravators and mitigators in any sentence, if you fall below that range, that the victim of a crime could petition a review of the sentence that falls below that range to the Court of Appeals. And lastly, there was some more cleanup language to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, where statutes require that an attorney or a physician serve on the board. And we'd like it to be also allowed to be a retired physician or attorney. We think the skills are the same, and they probably have a little bit more time to serve the public on those boards. So four very separate things. We think that they all do very small steps on balancing the rights of the accused and the rights of the victims of crime, and we appreciate your support.
So you just increase the eligibility of your compensation board members.
Correct.
And allowing a retired person, and as well for your attorney, or the attorney and the doc. Are there any questions on this legislation? Representative Stoltz, would you like to add your comments?
Bill Stoltz, proud to be part of the Matsu delegation here in Chino. I represent Samuels. My colleague has adequately handled it, and I value your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Does anyone have any, I think many of us have probably already heard this. And I know this is a very, I have had more calls about this bill in the last few days. This must be a very good bill. We must, okay. I've been given a question to ask.
Okay.
On the record, does this bar or impact a defendant's ability to file an expedited request?
No, Madam Chair. If you put it, the way that the bail works right now is you go before the magistrate first, and in a normal set of circumstances, the bail is set rather high. Mm-hmm. Because if there's alcohol or high emotions involved, the bail is set very high. The next bail hearing is from a judge in which you would consider that, and for a layman's term, that's the real bail is set then. Things have calmed down, the bail is then set. So, and from there on out, what we're looking at is instead of having a bail hearing every single day with no change, we're saying now you've got to wait 2 days unless something changes. And if something changes, you put it in writing, and you can have the bail hearing before then.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 54 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you.
House Bill 54, without objection, House Bill 54 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Okay. House Bill 286, is that you, Mary?
Yes.
Are you on that too?
I've got the little part. I've got the little.
You got the repealer or the effective date or something. We certainly have a lot of people to testify. Questions? We have Andy Lehman, Municipal Light and Power, Jane Posey, Municipal Light and Power, Dan Dickerson, Department of Revenue, and Martin Schultz, Division of Oil and Gas. So if you have any questions that need answers, they're online to help us. Okay.
I can give my...
Go ahead.
My bells are ringing, so
I'd like to give my short
part. Thank you. Thank you very much again, Madam Chair. And once again, for the record, Ralph Samuels from District 29. The first part, the small part of HB 286 deals with an issue that was brought to me by Municipal Light and Power. And the way that the royalty was valued by DNR was on the value of a contract that Shell had at the Beluga River Field with Municipal Light and Power. Municipal Light and Power then bought Shell's interest in the field itself. DNR agreed to use the contract price until the contract expired. The contract expires in 2005, and the language in the bill would allow DNR to use the transfer price now. Since there is no longer a sale going on, they own the gas in the field, they're transferring it to themselves. The transfer price is set by RCA, and I believe she left. RCA testified earlier that they were fully in support of this. So that's the small portion of the bill. And if there's any questions, I can answer questions right now, or my staff, Sarah Nielsen, can if I need to go to work.
Would you like for Kate Guyard to testify?
Yes.
In behalf of this, we'll be sure she gets out here before. And that's on which section?
One.
Section one.
Section one. Okay. When she gets out here, we'll have her testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Mary, would you like to do wrap-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have sections 2 through 9 of the bill.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Wagoner, and I am the aide to the Senate Resource Committee. Madam Chair, the Senate Resource Committee determined to use this bill for the portions of the for the expiration incentive credits that were formerly in House Bill 71. Very simply, two sections in House Bill 71 that were amended on the floor of the House. The Senate Resources Chairman decided that he didn't need to use those this year, but they were two clauses that he felt might be available to the legislature at some later point. So we took the expiration incentive program from that 71, House Bill 71, and put it into this bill. House Bill 71 is still in the possession of the Senate Resource Committee. This bill now, then, with the expiration incentive credits, it took the original incentive credits that were initially developed for the Alaska Peninsula for Bristol Bay. Mm-hmm. On the other body, it was expanded to include Healy Basin, the Manana Basin, Red Dog, and portions of the Cook Inlet. The Cook Inlet with different circumstances. The Cook Inlet legislation was also mirrored Senate Bill 163, which was Senator Wagoner's.
So these are all rather recent events?
All new,
so,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. So basically what this bill does is that it establishes a new set of expiration credits, and it's modeled based on the expiration credits that were authorized in 2003 in then Senate Bill 185. And actually, this committee was the first committee that heard those expiration credits, too. So it extends them to all the areas of Alaska south of the Brooks Range. There are some specific circumstances and standards for the Cook Inlet because the Cook Inlet's a more mature basin. And the two other things that are slightly different that the Senate Resources Committee did from the original House bill was that the Senate version eliminated the clause that eliminated ANWR. So ANWR was originally in the bill in 2003. ANWR is still in the legislation for credits. And the other thing that we did was there was some concern over the way regulations had been written for these credits for the 2003. We timelined the regulations for 2003, so they stop when that legislation expires in 2007, and these new credits have a different set of regulations. And that's what we did.
Kate Gaillard? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
And that's what we did, Madam Chair. We have had substantial support for the bill throughout the process. All of the areas, of course, that were included, including the original area, the Bristol Bay area, stand much in support of it.
Are we going to get billions of nasty letters that we're giving away the farm and we're doing all these things that are awful? And
Madam Chair, I don't think so. I mean, truly what we're trying to do is to put some oil in the pipeline.
We absolutely need it. And certainly in our area of the state, between my home and yours, there's a huge need for that increased production and refill those lines. Kate, when Ralph Samuels was here in talking about House Bill 286, he said the portion of the bill that he had included in this legislation that you had testified in favor of. And before he left, I asked him if he would like for you to supply your support or your testimony, and he said he would. So if you don't mind testifying on behalf of the RCA for Section 1.
Through the chair, pardon me, I had to chat with the Attorney General. Through the chair, the RCA has reviewed this legislation, and to give you a bit of background, it deals with the transfer price that MLMP charges itself. And because it's MLMP is a regulated utility, we reviewed the transfer price and issued an order and actually explained to MLMP how the commission wants them and what figures and monetary amounts costs the commission will accept in terms of a transfer price. So we have fully vetted the calculation, the mechanism for calculating the transfer price, and we are comfortable with this legislation. Annually, MLMP will file with us the transfer price calculation, which will happen. What will happen then is we will evaluate it. If we have questions or concerns, there'll be a 30-day comment period, and people will be able to comment on that transfer price. If the Attorney General, who represents the public advocate,
is concerned about that calculation, he can intervene in this process. So the public will have an opportunity to get involved in the calculation of the transfer price if he feels that it's necessary. So what I wanted to assure you was that there is a process in place. The transfer price will be calculated. I don't think DNR will ever have a problem with it, and we fully support the legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, I sat on the Anchorage Assembly when this original deal was cut, played a significant part in it, had no vested interest other than good public policy at the time, and I don't believe I have a conflict of interest.
We just have memory of it, huh?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. And Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess it's to the bill sponsors. We look at on page 3, it talks about a specific latitude, and since it runs through my district, I was wondering why for marginal fields and exploration that's going to be going on there, these tax credits weren't allowed on the slope.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the original tax credits are in place. Mm-hmm. This extends them out to 2010, and it extends them out to 2010 for only those areas south.
So the tax credits are in place for...
Yes, sir. They're in place right now. It was a four-year program, and it was, you know, an incentive program from 2003 to 2007. And actually, that's why we left the ANWR in there, so that they could continue to receive. Our understanding was there is at least one entity that is looking at doing seismic work in that area.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the distances are fairly great in that area, as I recall, when there are a distinction in the...
Madam Chair, the new credits are south of the Brooks Range.
Any other questions? Does anyone have any objection to us moving this out, if we want any more information? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 286 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Objection. House Bill 286 moves from committee with individual recommendations.
Thank you for your time.
Brief at ease, please. Just a minute. We'll take that discussion up till we get that other bill distributed. Okay, Mike, are you going to do the explanation on that? Thank you. We'll get to it in just a minute, Ian. We do have some revised language we're waiting on to that's currently being written and discussed somewhere, probably by some attorneys somewhere. So, Mike, if you could start us out on this governor's bill, an act relating to the compensation of the governor, lieutenant governor, and certain public officials, officers, and employees not covered by collective bargaining agreements, and providing for an effective date.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Tipples with the Department of Administration. I previously testified on the Senate version, so I keep my comments fairly brief here this morning. This bill will match up the statutory pay schedule for partially exempt and exempt employees in the legislative, judicial, and executive branches to the same pay schedule that we negotiated with the supervisory union. The House Rules Committee met and added two amendments. The amendments would increase the salary of the governor and lieutenant governor, and also put a delayed effective date on those provisions to December of 06, the date of the swearing in of the next governor. Mm-hmm. There was the second amendment added in the House Rules Committee, changed the salary of commissioners from 28E to a range of not less than 28 and not greater than 30.
Okay. And that has an effective date of just July 1. Okay?
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think probably most people have had a chance to review this, but why is it necessary for us to come back and do something like this? I know we've had lots of other references in the budget to agreements reached and the fact that many those folks who negotiate have already gotten increases. If we did not do this, what would the situation be for those employees in this building and in other parts of government service that are not represented by a union? What is the status of their current salary in comparison to their counterpart in the rest of government service?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, the statutory schedule is approximately 5% off of the supervisory and the GGU contracts. And this bill would match that up and make sure that we pay our employees who are paid at a particular range the same. So your 21 would be paid at the same rate as a 21 in a collective bargaining, under the employee working under collective bargaining pay schedule. And to address why it is so important to fix the statutory schedule, certainly the first item is the equity issue. We feel it's very important to pay our employees equitably. We have a statutory mandate to do that, pay employees like pay for like work. And we think a 21 ought to be a 21 on all the scales. But two additional points that I've pointed out in the past, I think in dealing with recruitment and encouraging our long-term and more experienced and valuable employees to move up, these changes are important because you have a situation without this bill where we'll see a 9% difference between the statutory and the schedule and the schedule that exists in the union contracts. When it gets to be such a large disparity, we have a hard time recruiting and we have a hard time encouraging those individuals to move up into supervisory positions when the result of that moving up could be less salary in many cases. So,
well, I know, and that equates to about a 5% difference before the current contract and the coming increase.
That's
so the 9% total is substantial and certainly makes it, I think every legislator can kind of tell the horror story of, particularly when a new administration comes in and next thing you know, everyone you usually see in the building is gone, and such as yourself, and who then go on to bigger and better things. But I'm very concerned that if we don't do something, that we'll have a whole group of people who have, like you say, just there's a disparity in their pay scale. And Art Chance, did you have anything you wanted to bring to the table today? Okay. Thank you. Did anyone have any questions for Mr. Chance or for Mike Tibbles? Okay, Mike, we'll wait for that amendment to reach us, and then we'll get it together, okay? Thank you. And Ian, you want to hurry back?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to jump the gun on you there. We're
just looking at the wrong agenda. Well, that's all right. We hadn't distributed the file folder because we had thought about having it later this afternoon, so we just now we're back on schedule. So if you could explain it to us, please. Introduce yourself and give your affiliation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ian Fisk, staff to Representative Thomas, and thank you for hearing HB 218 today. This bill is about the private nonprofit hatcheries in Alaska and how they recover their costs. And I should start by saying that Representative Thomas is and has always been a big supporter of the hatchery system. He helped develop one of the local hatcheries here. What we're addressing in this bill is the method by which hatcheries recovered their costs. And we want to basically present another option to the hatcheries, because the way they do it now, they contract, they issue a contract to one processor usually, and only a couple of vessels actually harvest the fish right in front of a hatchery in order to recover the cost. And the rate of the total run that is actually harvested by hatcheries varies greatly around the state. But what this bill will do is allow a hatchery, through an assessment on the fishermen, to open up their process if they choose to do so. I want to make that clear, as we have all the way through the process, that this was is intended and will remain an option. There's nothing in this bill that requires a hatchery to use this alternative method if they do not think that it's in the hatchery's best interest. But basically, it's a bill that would create an assessment, a variable rate assessment, and the parameters of that are spelled out in the bill. and the hatchery would basically work with representatives of the commercial fishing fleets to develop a process by which they could do this, but that the hatcheries maintain that option. In the name of brevity here, I'll just open it up for questions at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ian Fisk? Oh, Senator Sedman.
So I take it there's unanimous support for this?
Senator Stedman, I would guess that if you went down to the docks and talked to fishermen, you would get about as close to unanimous support as you would get on any fishing industry bill. But the only opponents that we've heard from have been the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association's board. There were some concerns from the Valdez hatchery, although what they asked us to do was take out some findings that we had in the bill, which we did before the last committee.
I'm under the understanding that this is a result of and more applicable to the cost recovery at Hidden Falls?
Senator Stedman, that's correct through the chair. It's correct because Hidden Falls is one of the more successful hatcheries in northern southeast Ensurah, it's called in fishing jargon, is one of the most successful hatchery programs in the state. And this bill isn't intended to impugn them. In fact, we think that they could be the first to use this method because they actually don't take that much for their cost recovery. In other words, their debt has gotten to the point because they paid it down, they're in a better position to take this risk than other hatcheries. And when I say risk, it's because they're allowing the cost recovery to be collected through an assessment and not by simply hiring a couple of boats. So I don't know if that makes it any clearer to you, but.
Right, so Madam Chair, I take it then Hidden Falls Hatchery is in support of this.
Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, Hidden Falls is part of Ensurah, and I do not believe that hatchery is in support of this bill.
So Ensurah is Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture
Association. Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. It's a mouthful.
It's okay, yeah.
We have worked through the chair, Senator Stedman, we have worked with the board, the executive director in particular of Ensurah throughout this process, and we have made numerous changes that he suggested, including adjusting the ceiling on the rate at his suggestion. The findings were removed. We've worked with them numerous times on this, and I think that it's indicative of the general lay of the land here in this hatchery cost recovery issue that even if we're presenting them with an option, I think part of the concern is that they're afraid it's not going to be optional in the long run, that some kind of Darth Vader's going to come from the sky and slam something through to make this a mandatory bill, and that is absolutely not the intent of the sponsor, and we have said that on the record I don't know how many times to try to make Northern Southeast comfortable with it. It's only an option. They don't have to exercise it unless they think it's in their best interest.
Well, and I don't know a lot about fisheries. In fact, there's some of us who have stated on record that we never want to see another fishery bill ever because
we don't
understand them and they're out of our territory. But is this one of those things, one thing that kind of concerns me sometime in an area that I don't understand terribly well, is this one of those things, though, that you could have this action this year and then next year come back and do something else that would implement part of it that makes what is benign now more active or in any way have a second piece of legislation or a third piece of legislation that causes this to be the start of something bad or different or?
Senator Green, thank you. I think this is the start of something good. It's the first step towards providing another method by which fishermen can access more fish. And that's another important thing that I should have stated right at the beginning. The hatcheries were created during times of low abundance to enhance our runs of fish for the benefit of the common property users. They're not intended to be the primary harvesters of the fish. However, as a method of recovering a cost, the Department of Fish and Game allows them to harvest fish under the current method. This simply puts into statute another option, and I think it's the start of something good. However, it wouldn't be proper to make it a mandatory thing because of the fact that there's so many hatcheries that have different financial situations, different debt loads, different types of fish that they produce, et cetera. So I think it's the start of something good.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Oh, Senator Stedman.
Maybe you could, I recognize that there's a lot of fishermen that support it, and apparently I got a letter here that says there's some that don't, but the ones I hear from are supportive of this concept, and that's clear, and I think, I would imagine the processors are in support of it too. I would expect that, at least the majority of them. But clearly NSRA, which is the hatchery that appears to be targeted, is not in support of it. And who, what geared groups are on their board? And maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Who's on their board, and not individually, but geared groups, and who they represent?
Ian, before you answer, I think I keep hearing the bell, so I think we probably should get to the floor. We'll continue at the call of the chair. And if you want to have answers to Senator Stedman's questions ready and any other information you might feel would be good for the committee to come back, and it'll be, I cannot give you the time right now, but if you'll kind of keep in touch, then we'll post the time. So
thanks for hearing the bill.
And then we'll go back and try, if we can get the language on House Bill 98 for this afternoon, we'll do that. We'll do House Bill 218 and House Bill 147, if we can get the language on that. And we are at recess until the call of the chair. Senate Finance will come to order, back to order, after our recess. In this morning's hearing on Senate Bill 157 regarding the regulatory cost charges, there was a question about the language on page 2, which is currently on your CS on 15. Senator Stedman, would you move the CS version Y for our work draft, please?
Yes, I'd like to move the CS for Senate Bill number 157, version Y.
I'll object for explanation. And I noticed that we have Brian Bjorkquist back on, and Kate Gallard is here. If you want to come up, Kate, and you can kind of instruct me who is to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would recommend that the Attorney General speak first
okay.
on this issue. Thank you.
Okay. Brian, could you help us out here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Brian Bjorkquist, Assistant Attorney General. We worked with Legislative Council to come up with alternative language for Section 3 to make more clear that the limitation on liability for the owner of the transmission line is going to have be entitled to not be liable to the extent that damages are caused by the operation at that voltage that exceeds the original design standards, or if the voltage violates the applicable standards of the National Electric Safety Code. If everybody agrees that's what's intended with this, and we worked out the language, and we think this accomplishes that intent.
Okay, thank you, Brian, for joining us again this afternoon, and we appreciate your helping on the redraft of the language. Kate, do you have any information to share with us?
Madam Chair, no, I conclude my statements. Thank you.
Okay. We don't have anyone else online or in the building to testify on this, and I think we've done I appreciate the work done on this to get the conflict cleared up. And Senator Stedman, if you would move the bill, we'll...
I'd like to make a motion that we move the bill from Finance, version Y.
Senate Bill 157.
CS for Senate Bill 157, Finance.
And that's with the fiscal notes and...
Notes and other recommendations.
Okay. So objection to moving out 157. Senate Bill 157 is moved from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Thank you very much. House Bill 147.
Motion, Madam Chair.
I don't think... Is this a CS we need to adopt on 147? That from the House? No, that's no. No, we don't have to do anything.
No, we need, we have a CS. Where is it?
Oh, it's a Senate CS we need. Would you move it easy, please? Senator Sedman, could I get you to move version Y?
Yes, sir. Version Y? I've got version F.A. What's that?
Reproduce.
Number 147, Finance, version Y.
And we have version Y before us as our work draft. Linda Hall, good to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. The Senate CS has two changes from the House CS. These are both language that were in the original SB 108. Section 1 on page 2 is identical language from SB 108, so there are no changes. The CS adds that language to the House CS.
Okay.
The second change is on page 17. This also has language from Senate Bill 108. It has been modified and to streamline the language to meet some of the concerns that have been voiced at other hearings, not in this hearing. But basically, this language is to give some regulatory standards for reporting to the for the Union Health Trusts. Mm-hmm. We have made, as I said, some modifications in the language, and some of the things that were objected to have been removed. But generally, we still have the requirement of an audited financial statement and an actuarial memorandum. We have no longer required quarterly financial reports, but we still have the actuarial financial reporting requirements that were in SB 108, as heard by this committee earlier this week.
Mm-hmm. As a reminder, we have heard Senate Bill 108 previously in committee, and as Linda pointed out, this is essentially the same as 108 as it's come to us with those. Are there any other major changes from 108 in this bill that we need to hear about?
No, there are not.
And are you satisfied with the condition of the bill, and that will it serve the purpose for the division to do good work? And
this will allow the division to provide for, I think, more streamlined regulation, mm-hmm. and to allow us to have the tools we need to appropriately oversee those entities we regulate.
Okay. Are there any questions for the sponsor on the work draft? We have, we'll take just a brief ease to get the new fiscal note distributed. We have House Bill 147 before us. The new fiscal note has been distributed to you, and it went from a zero to a 38,000. What do we have here, Linda?
The fiscal note that you have before you has gone from zero to, and I don't have a copy of the new one, but I know what it is. It is the same fiscal note that was on Senate Bill 108. It is to provide for the division to increase staff by one person to handle consumer complaints that come to our office as a result of some of the additional oversight authority we have here.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for the director? Senator Wolken.
Madam Chair, I'd report House Bill 147 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Objection? Not. House Bill 147 passed out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ian Fisk, staff to Representative Thomas.
Did you have come back with any information or answers that we need to follow up on? I know we were sort of in the middle of a question when we left.
I believe Senator, thank you, Madam Chair, I believe Senator Stedman's question was how many commercial fishermen are on the board of the Regional Aquaculture Association in question? There are 15 commercial fishermen on the board, and those are split up according to the three predominant gear groups, Senator, the trollers, the gillnetters, and the seiners.
Any follow-up, Senator Stedman?
No, Madam Chair, I think we'll just go forward with the process on this bill and see how it goes.
Okay, thank you. You said trawlers, seiners, and what?
Trollers.
Trollers.
Madam Chair, seiners and gillnetters.
Gillnetters. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Okay. Online we have Pete Esquiro from Sitka. Are you there, Pete?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here.
Would you begin your testimony, give your name and your affiliation, please?
Okay. Pete Esquiro. I am general manager of the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association based here in Sitka. NSRAL continues to oppose House Bill 18. We have testified at every hearing, and we have worked with the bill sponsor to try to make improvements to the bill that would perhaps give, you know, some more reason for any hatchery operator to elect to use the assessment option, the subject of House Bill 218. We still feel that there are many major issues that surrounding House Bill 218 that need to be aired and need to be discussed. The following is just a list of some of the concerns which have been expressed by fishermen. First of all, is this assessment going to be enforceable? What will happen in terms of the net value of the fishery resource compared to now? How do we get this program off the ground, and where does the money for the first year of the assessment program guarantees come from? Are the effects on all fishermen equal? What is the consequence of this shift in relation to the Southeast Enhanced Salmon Allocation Plan? What is the result of applying the assessment program to other gear groups outside of the same fishermen? What does this do to the hatchery access Chinook troll fishery? Who will be making up any shortfalls that could possibly result from year to year in the assessment collections? We have some concerns about broodstock collection. You know, we're going to basically have to have some of our broodstock, hire people to catch broodstock for us, essentially in competition, or we are going to have to institute some other kinds of closures for the protection of broodstock. Right now, we have a formula that the NSRAL board applies to cost recovery, which allows for the time when, say, one of the programs doesn't get the number of fish back to it that it anticipates. So when there's a lower projection for a hatchery, for any particular hatchery, cost recovery at one of the other locations can help compensate for that shortfall. If we start pulling one program out of one segment of the program out, you know, it is going to have some kind of impact on the total program. There are a number of other questions relating to harvests of other species besides coho, and some other concerns related to how will enforcement be conducted over there, and the replacement plan better or worse for a majority of the commercial salmon fishermen in northern southeast Alaska? As you can see, there are some pretty heavy-duty issues that still need to be thought about, discussed, And up to now, few, if any, of these have really had much discussion time. I'd like to say a little bit about Provision B in the bill. We basically object to the overlaying of another level of bureaucracy to any Hatchery's administrative and planning process. Determining the reasonableness of operating and maintenance costs is a job of and the purview of the Board of Directors. It's not the Department of Revenue, it's not the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, or anyone other than the Corporation's Board of Directors. The Hatchery Corporation Board of Directors carries the total burden of the fiduciary responsibility for the corporation. Determining reasonableness is their job. And the NCROP board, I believe, has obviously done a very good job of this, as evidenced by the corporation's years of successful performance. It has been pointed out that House Bill 218 is permissive, and so why would we oppose it? I guess there really is not an answer to that because essentially I believe in having a lot of options. So I, you know, to what we do and seriously looking at other options. I think the option that's been presented so far has a ways to go yet before it's ready. It's my opinion that House Bill 18, from the very beginning, has been a bill about managing the Hidden Falls chum fishery. Some seiners want guaranteed midweek openings. Others know that that is not always possible. Unfortunately, the fishing business is a continuous series of variables and moving targets. That's partly why it interests so many of us. In managing a fishery for multiple goals, there's only one certainty. And that is nothing is guaranteed, and we do the best that we can to achieve as many goals as possible. And our paramount goal here at NCROP has always been and will always be providing as many fish as we possibly can to the common property fisheries. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Well, thank you very much for testifying. Did you have any questions to ask, Senator Stebbins?
No, I have some comments, though, and I thank Mr. Squirrel for taking the time out to call in on this bill.
Ian, did you have any comment or response or questions? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess there are a lot of details in how this plan would work on a hatchery-by-hatchery basis, and those details should be worked out outside of the legislative body. This bill, it provides a framework that provides flexibility for each hatchery. As I mentioned in my testimony earlier today, every hatchery has a different situation. And fishermen from around our fisheries in coastal Alaska have expressed interest in changing the cost recovery system. It so happens that the first people that have really come forward to attempt to provide this option are from the same group here in Southeast Alaska, but that's why this bill would be is a broader application, because it could be used in a number of different places. Mr. Esquiro is free to work out the differences and the issues that he raises with the groups in his area, because this bill does not force or change his hatchery's fiduciary responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
I could, Madam Chair. This is the only committee of referral on this particular bill. It doesn't seem to be timely as far as or ripe for moving forward. Clearly, there's no interest in NCRA, Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture, in changing their cost recovery for this season by the letter dated April 29th and the testimony of 5 minutes ago. So I would like to see this bill held and moved on into, wrapped up into the Resources Committee, so the Resources Committee can try to work out compromise with the hatcheries and the stakeholders, if possible.
Okay, thank you, Senator Stedman.
I will take a brief at ease.
Come here.